Oh, of course there are always some odd fish among the quota men sent by the magistrates, but this time we have very few downright thieves. Only one parricide that was found incapable of pleading and sent to the navy, and after all he will scarcely carry on his capers here. He will scarcely find another father aboard, and much the same applied to the poachers. Upon the whole, I am very pleased. What with the old leaven and the new, as it says in the Bible, I do not doubt but we shall have a tolerable brisk crew by the time we reach the flag, and to encourage 'em I have laid in a fine stock of private powder, the stock of a fireworks maker lately deceased, a most prodigious bargain. It was the clerk of check that gave me wind of it. He means to marry the widow, and although it is a little mixed with red orpiment and so on, the ordnance master swears it is sound. The only thing between me and perfect felicity, said Jack, thrusting the cloud of legal troubles still farther back into the recesses of his mind, is the threat of these parsons and the absence of the other lieutenants. Manning always means a prodigious amount of work, and far too much of it falls on poor Pullings. We must have more lieutenants at once. Pullings is quite worn out, and the next few days will be rough going indeed.
So he is too, and grown strangely snappish from want of repose. He rounded on me with inconceivable ferocity for turning a small paltry handful of men away. His appetite for hands is unmeasured, insatiable, inhuman. I must give him a comfortable dose tonight, 75 drops of the tincture of laudanum, and tomorrow he will be the complacent, amiable, obliging Thomas Pullings we've always known. Otherwise it must be the blue pill for him. Blue pill and black draught.
With any luck, the others should appear tomorrow, and that will take some of the load off his shoulders. And the Commissioner has a plan for sending the parsons in a merchantman. Your mates came aboard this afternoon, I collect. I hope you're pleased with them.
I have no doubt that they are as competent as their certificates state them to be, as competent as we have any right to expect in surgeons. Stephen was a physician, and surgeons, though worthy souls often enough taken individually, had not yet lived down their long, long association with barbers. But even if the one had been Podalirius and the other Machion, I should still have preferred to be alone.
"Are they not quite the thing?" asked Jack. "I will try to arrange a transfer if you do not like them."
"You are very good, but it is not that I have taken any disgust either to the young man or to the old. It is only that I dislike the whole notion of subordination. The corporal lurks in almost every bosom, and each man tends to use authority when he has it, thus destroying his natural relationship with his fellows, a disastrous state of affairs for both sides. Do away with subordination, and you do away with tyranny. Without subordination we should have no Neros, no Tamerlanes, no Bonapartes.
Stuff, said Jack. Subordination is the natural order. There is subordination in heaven. Thrones and dominions take precedence over powers and principalities, archangels and ordinary foremast angels, and so it is in the navy. You've come to the wrong shop for anarchy, brother.
Be that as it may, said Stephen, I had far rather sail alone. Yet with some 600 souls crammed into this insecure and mouldy wooden vessel, many verminous, many poxed, and some perhaps harbouring the seeds of the jail fever, I need some assistance even in the ordinary daily course, to say nothing of action, God forbid. And in point of fact, since I am likely to be absent some of the time, I have taken peculiar pains to come by an exceptionally well-qualified, well-recommended senior assistant. But listen, why are you so opposed to these clergymen? Surely you are no longer so weak as to set store by superstition.
Of course not, said Jack quickly. It is only for the sake of the hands, his invariable reply. Besides, he said after a pause, you cannot talk bawdy with parsons. It ain't fitting.
But you never do talk bawdy, said Stephen. It was true, or at least almost true. Although no kind of a prude, Jack Aubrey was a man who preferred action to talk, fact to phantasm, and although he did possess a small stock of lewd stories for the end of dinners, when imaginations grew warm and often lubricious, he usually forgot them, or left out the point.
Oh, well, said Jack, and then, did you ever meet Bach?
Which Bach?
London Bach.
Not I.
I did. He wrote some pieces for my Uncle Fisher, and his young man copied them out fair. But they were lost years and years ago, so last time I was in town I went to see whether I could find the originals.
The young man has set up on his own, having inherited his master's music library. We searched through the papers. Such a disorder you would hardly credit, and I had always supposed publishers were as neat as bees. We searched for hours, and no uncle's pieces did we find. But the whole point is this. Bach had a father.
Heavens, Jack, what things you tell me! Yet upon recollection I seem to have known other men in much the same case.
And this father, this old Bach, you understand me, had written piles and piles of musical scores in the pantry.
A whimsical place to compose in, perhaps. But then birds sing in trees, do they not? Why not antediluvian Germans in a pantry?
I mean the piles were kept in the pantry. Mice and black beetles and cookmaids had played Old Harry with some cantatas and a vast great passion, according to St. Mark, in High Dutch. But lower down all was well, and I brought away several pieces, cello for you, fiddle for me, and some for both together. It is strange stuff, fugues and suites of the last age, crabbed and knotted sometimes, and not at all in the modern taste. But I do assure you, Stephen, there is meat in it. I have tried this partita in C a good many times, and the argument goes so deep, so close and deep, that I scarcely follow it yet, let alone make it sing. I should love to hear it played really well, to hear Viotti dashing away.
Stephen studied the cello suite in his hand, booming and humming sotto voce.
Tweedly, 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 deedly, deedly, pom, pom, pom. Oh, this would call for the delicate hand of the world, he said. Otherwise it would sound like boars dancing. Oh, the double stopping! And how to bow it!
Shall we make an attempt upon the D minor double sonata? Said Jack, and knit up the ravelled sleeve of care with sore labour's bath?
By all means, said Stephen. A better way of dealing with a sleeve cannot be imagined.
Neither had at any time been more than a fairly accomplished amateur. Of recent years, neither had had much leisure for practice, and various wounds, an American musket ball in Jack's case, a French interrogation in Stephen's, had so slowed down their fingers that in places they were obliged to indicate the notes by hooting, and as they felt their way through the difficult sonata time after time, they made the night so hideous that Killick's indignation broke out at last, and he said to the captain's cook,
"There they go again! Tweedly deedly, tweedly deedly, belly aching the whole bleeding night, and a toasted cheese seizing unto their plates like goddamn glue, which I dursn't go in to fetch them, and never an honest tune from beginning to end."
Perhaps there was not. But after a particularly difficult, severe, and abstract passage, the last movement ended with a triumphant summing up and resolution that they could both play at first sight, and that they repeated again and again. And the grave happiness of the music was still with Captain Aubrey when he walked on to his quarter-deck in the bright morning to see his stump t'gallant masts and their attendant royals come aboard, followed almost immediately by the Tamar's barge, bringing a score of glum but resigned and obviously competent skates to the larboard side, and by a Plymouth wherry with two pink-faced young men, very carefully shaved, wearing identical uniforms, their best, and solemn expressions. The wherry hooked on to the starboard main-chains. The young men ran up the side in order of seniority. 2 whole weeks lay between them, saluted the quarter-deck, and looked quickly fore and aft for the officer of the watch. They saw no calm, dignified figure, pacing up and down, with a telescope under his arm and an epaulette on his shoulder. But after a moment, a very dirty, tall, thin man in tarry trousers and a round jacket stepped towards them from the busy crowd at the foot of the foremast. His eyes were rimmed with red, his expression stern, as well it might be, Pullings having been obliged to keep watch, as well as carry out all his other duties since the Worcester left Portsmouth. The first young man took off his hat and said in a humble voice,
"Collins, sir, come on board, if you please."
"Whiting, sir, if you please, come on board," said the other.
"You are very welcome, gentlemen," said Pullings. "I will not give you my hand, it being covered with slush, but you are very welcome. There is a mortal deal of work to be done if ever we are to put to sea. There is not a moment to lose."
Jack was speaking to the gunner at the time, explaining that the private powder in the kegs marked X was mixed with red orpiment, and XX with antimony or copper, while still others had lycopodium or camphor or strontium, but he noticed with satisfaction that neither of the two young men did, in fact, lose a moment. Their sea-chests were scarcely aboard before they were out of their fine clothes, actively forwarding the work on the Fortegallum mast, as deep in slush as any of those concerned with easing its head through the awkward trestle trees and cap.
"It may not be fighting powder, Mr. Borrell," said Jack, "but it will answer very well for practice. Let a dozen rounds be filled for each gun. I should like to see how the people shape as soon as we put to sea, perhaps tomorrow on the evening tide."
"A dozen rounds it is, sir," said the gunner, with deep approval.
Captain Aubrey belonged to the school of Douglas and Collingwood, men who believed that a ship's prime purpose was to bring cannon within range of the enemy, and then to fire with extreme speed and accuracy. And Borrell supported this view with all his heart. He walked off to fill cartridge with his mates in the magazine, and Jack looked up at the rising fortogallant mast with a smile. There was order in that apparent chaos of men, spars and ropes, and Tom Pullings had the whole operation well in hand. He looked down, and his smile faded. A small boat, crammed with parsons, was approaching the ship, followed by another with a lady in mourning, a small boy by her side.
"I had hoped to persuade her to put the boy to school," said Jack to Stephen after supper, as they sat down to a comparatively simple Scarlatti piece that they both knew well. "I had hoped to convince her that a voyage of this kind, a few months on the Toulon blockade, a relieving turn with no future in it, a mere parenthesis, as you said the other day, would be no use to her boy, and that there were many other captains with schoolmasters and a long commission ahead of them. I named half a dozen, and I had hoped to ship no first voyagers this time, no squeakers, no use to me, and I no use to them. But she would not be denied, wept upon my word, shed tears. I have never been so wretched in my life."
"Mrs. Callamy is an officer's widow, I collect."
"Yes. Edward Callamy and I were shipmates in Theseus, before he was made post into the Atalanta. Then they gave him the Rochester, 74, just such a ship as this. She was lost with all hands in the great autumn blow of the year 8. If I had told her that we came from the same yard, she might have taken the little brute away."
"Poor little brute. Pullings found him bathed in tears and comforted him. The child led him downstairs, below, and gave him a large piece of plum cake. This argues a grateful heart in Mr. Callamy. I hope he may thrive, though he is so puny, so very puny."
"Oh, I dare say he will, if he is not drowned or knocked on the head. Mrs. Borrell will look after him. The Navy is equipped to breed up squeakers, after all. But I tell you what, Stephen, I tell you what. The Navy is not equipped to deal with a whole goddamned, a whole blessed convocation of clergy. It is not six parsons that are come aboard, but seven. Seven, upon my sacred honour. How I hope this breeze holds true for three more tides, so that we may put to sea before they send us half the bench of bishops."
The wind did not hold true. The Worcester had barely shipped her new stumps, rattled down the shrouds, completed her water and received the Port Admiral's visit before an ominous swell set in, causing her to pitch and roll even in the sheltered hamoways, and foretelling the great grey swaths of rain driving in on a strong southwester, whose force steadily increased day after day, emptying the sound, pinning the men of war to their moorings in hamoways, and the merchant ships in catwater, driving the Brest team off their blockade into Torbay, and scattering the shores with driftwood, much of it ancient wreckage, English, French, Spanish, Dutch, and neutral. But some was recent, and this was mostly English, for not only were there now far more English merchantmen than foreigners to be wrecked, but the Royal Navy, keeping the sea in all weathers the whole year round, was fast wearing out, and although new ships were continually being built as fast as limited treasure and supplies would allow, many others had to be kept in active service when they were no longer seaworthy. 13 had been lost this year, quite apart from those taken by the Americans or the French. Yet at least this delay gave the Worcester time for all kinds of last-minute arrangements, such as a provision of soap or blotting paper, so often forgotten in even the best ordered ships until they have sunk the land, and with it all sources of supply. It also allowed still more people to put off with requests to Captain Aubrey, still more letters to come aboard for Admiral Thornton's squadron and for the Worcester herself. Some of these were addressed to her captain. Long, intricate, and not particularly encouraging letters from his lawyer, letters that made Jack look careworn and old.
"How I do loathe this hanging about," he said. "It is a kind of enforced unpunctuality. And the damned thing about it is that Sophie could perfectly well have come down for a week or so, and Diana too, I dare say. Yet at least it has brought you acquainted with your new messmates. You must be pretty crowded down there, but I hope you find them good company, learned and so on."
Jack had not yet dined with the wardroom and its new inhabitants. Not only had he been extremely busy with the re-stowing of the hold to improve the Worcester's trim, but partly out of custom and partly out of a desire to forget his legal worries, he had also dined with other captains almost every day. Fine, hard-drinking parties, most of them, and a moderately good way of overlaying care for a while. He had also travelled quite far inland to pay his respects to Lady Thornton, and to ask whether he might carry anything from home to the Admiral.
"Yet now I come to think of it," he went on, "one of them, the Scotchman, is not a parson at all, but a professor of moral philosophy to be delivered to Port Mahon, where presumably they are in need of his services. Moral philosophy! How does that differ from your kind, Stephen?"
"Why, natural philosophy is not concerned with ethics, virtues and vices, or metaphysics. The fact that the dodo has a keel to her breastbone, whereas the ostrich and her kind have none, presents no moral issue. Nor does the dissolution of gold by aqua regia. We erect hypotheses, to be sure, some of us to a most stupendous height, but we always hope to sustain them by demonstrable facts in time. These are not the province of the moralist. Perhaps it might be said that your moral philosopher is in pursuit of wisdom rather than of knowledge. And indeed, what he is concerned with is not so much the object of knowledge as of intuitive perception. He is scarcely susceptible of being known. Yet whether wisdom can be any more profitably pursued than happiness is a question. Certainly the few moral philosophers I have known do not seem to have been outstandingly successful in either, whereas some natural philosophers, such as Sir Humphrey Davy—" Stephen carried on to the end of his long, his very long sentence, but a great while before he stopped it was apparent to him that Captain Aubrey was meditating a joke.
"So I suppose," he said, smiling so broadly that his blue eyes were not more than twinkling slits in his red face, "that you and Sir Humphrey could be described as immoral philosophers."
"Sure, there may be some poor, thin, barren minds that would catch at such a paltry clench," said Stephen. "Pothouse wits that might, if their beery genius soared so high, also call Professor Graham an unnatural philosopher."
Captain Aubrey heaved silently for a while. Few men relished their own wit more than Jack. And then, smiling still, he said,
"Well, at all events, I hope he is good company. I can imagine an unnatural and an immoral philosopher arguing the toss for hours to the admiration of all hands. Ha, ha, ha!"
"We have barely exchanged a dozen words. He seems a reserved gentleman, and perhaps a little deaf. I have hardly formed any opinion of him, though he must be widely read, sure, to occupy a chair in a respectable university. I believe I have seen his name to a recent edition of the Nicomachean Ethics."
"And what of the others? The parsons proper?"
Ordinarily they did not exchange their views about Stephen's fellow members of the wardroom mess. Jack, for example, had not said a word about his extreme displeasure at the arrival of Mr. Summers, rather than either of the lieutenants he had applied for, nor of his intimate conviction that the young man had been in Plymouth for several days, reporting aboard only when the hard labour of fitting the Worcester for sea was done. But the parsons were no part of the ship's company. They were passengers. They might be discussed, and Stephen described them briefly. One was a West Country rector, an invalid who hoped to find health in the Mediterranean, where his cousin commanded the Andromache.
"I wish he may get there at all. Such a cachexie I have rarely seen ambulant."
All the others were unbeneficed clergymen. Two had been ushers in schools for young gentlemen and thought any other life preferable to that, even on shipboard. Two had tried long and hard and unsuccessfully to live by their pens. They were pitifully thin and shabby. And one from the West Indies had ruined himself by the invention of a double-bottomed defecator.
"It appears that the machine, which is designed to purify sugar, requires only the investment of a little more capital to sweep the board, and that any gentleman with a few hundreds to spare might set up his coach on the profits within a very short space of time.
But come, Joy, are we ever to attack Scarlatti, the poor soul, or are we to sit here until the crack of doom, as wind-bound as our unhappy Argosy?"
"There is not a moment to be lost," said Jack, reaching for his bow. "Let the battle begin."
The grey days crept by with continual heavy rain, and the gale working up a sea that made the Worcester pitch and roll at her moorings to such a degree that most of the black coats deserted the wardroom table, and even ship-visiting came to a stop. But on the afternoon of Tuesday the wind backed into the east, just far enough to allow the Worcester to warp out into the Sound and shape a course, every staysail set, to sail-yards braced up, cracking taut, all seamen on deck, all landsmen ordered below, for Penley Point. Then, shaving the headland so close that the quarter-deck held its collective breath, while Stephen privately crossed himself, she edged away, brought the breeze onto her larboard quarter, dropped her courses, and ran clear out into the channel under all plain sail, the first to leave Plymouth apart from a revenue cutter since the blow began.
"The skipper is in a hell-fire hurry," observed Summers to Mowat, as Jack cast a look at Rame Head, looming through the rain on the starboard beam, and stepped purposefully below.
"Wait until you see him at quarters," said Mowat. "There will be an exercise tonight, and you will have to rattle your guns out pretty brisk to please him."
"Oh, as for that," said Summers, "I'm not at all afraid. I know how to make my men skip, I believe."
Jack was indeed in a hell-fire hurry. Not only did he always long to be at sea, and even more so this time than usual, out of lawyer's reach and before he could be saddled with a convoy, but he knew very well that the Brest squadron had been blown off their station, and that he had a fair chance of snapping up any French privateer that might take advantage of their absence and of the easterly wind to run into the ocean, there to cruise for British merchantmen, privateers, or even, with great luck, a frigate. For although any French frigate he had ever seen would surely have the legs of the Worcester, which added sloth to unresponsiveness and lack of beauty, his ship could throw a broadside of 721 pounds from her long guns alone, enough to disable any frigate at long range if only they were pointed straight and fired briskly. He was in a hurry, but a cheerful hurry. He had brought his ship to sea after a delay far shorter than many he had known, in spite of the time spent in reducing her masts to something more near his liking. Thanks to Fanshawe's kindness and Mowat's zeal, his people amounted to 613 souls, only 27 short of the Worcester's official complement, with a far higher proportion of seamen than he had any right to expect. And although, thanks to her captain's weakness, she carried the usual nursery of very young gentlemen, some useless mids, and a lieutenant he did not care for, Jack had upon the whole been let off very lightly. With his first lieutenant and the gunner, he plunged down into the familiar reek of the lower deck. Bilge water, cable slime, mould, hard-worked, unwashed men. Well over 500 hands slept here, close-packed. And since it had been impossible to open the gun ports or pipe up hammocks this last week and more, the reek was even stronger than usual, although the long, low space was empty now, apart from a couple of heaps of hopelessly seasick landsmen, apparently dead, and a few swabbers. But Jack was not concerned with them, nor with the stench, a part of life from his earliest days. His business was with the ship's main armament— the two tiers of massive guns, 32-pounders, stretching fore and aft in the gloom, bowsed tight up against the side, uttering squeaks and groans as the rolls shifted their concentrated 3 tons an inch or so in spite of the well-heaved frapping. With the light crew that brought the Worcester down, he had not been able to fire the lower-deck guns, but he was confident that with the weather clearing he should do so later in the day, and he was eager to begin. Gunnery was his passion, and he could not rest easy until he had at least started the long and arduous process of working up the gun crews to his own exacting standards of rapid, and above all, accurate fire. Holding a lantern, he walked bent low along the tiers, each gun neat and square, with its sponge, worm, rammer, powder horn, bit, quoin, and hand spikes laid just so. He listened attentively to Borrell's account of each, and to Pullings's provisional arrangements for the crews, and once again he blessed the luck that had given him reliable officers, as well as enough right men-of-war's men to provide at least an experienced first and second captain for each piece.
"Well," he said at the end of their tour, "I believe we may have some live practice this evening. I hope so, indeed. We can afford quite a number of rounds. My dock powder was a most amazing bargain, and we fairly cleared the widow's shop. You have plenty filled, Mr. Borrell?"
"Oh, yes, sir. But I was obliged to fill promiscuous, which some of the kegs had no marks, and others two or three, and very old-fashioned some of it smelled and tasted, too. Not that it was not very fine-corned and bold and dry, sir. I mean no reflection."
"I'm sure you do not, Master Gunner, but I hope you did not taste much of the powder with antimony in it. Antimony is ticklish stuff, they say. It is most uncommon damp down here," he added, pushing his finger deep into the mould on the beam over his bowed head. "We certainly need a thorough housewarming, as you might put it."
"Much of the wet comes through the horse holes in the manger, sir," said Pullings, who was very willing to find some virtue in his ship. "The boatswain has a party there with extra horse bags, but upon the whole, sir, she is pretty tight. Tighter than I had expected with this swell. She certainly labours much less with these new topgallant masts, and she scarcely heaves under the chains at all."
"Oh, a swell like this don't put her out," said Jack. "As far as she was designed at all, she was designed for the Atlantic. But what she will do in those short, steep Mediterranean seas that cut up so quick, well, it will be interesting to find out. And it will be interesting to see the effect of antimony. The effect on the guns, I mean, Mr. Borrell. I'm sure you would have to eat a peck of it to do a man of your constitution any harm." "Pray, Dr. Maturin," he said on the quarter-deck, "what is the effect of antimony?"
"It is a diaphoretic, an expectorant, and a moderate cholagogue, but we use it chiefly as an emetic. You have heard of the everlasting antimony pill, sure?"
"Not I."
"It is one of the most economical forms of physic known to man, since a single pill of the metal will serve a numerous household, being ingested, rejected, and so recovered. I have known one handed down for generations, perhaps from the time of Paracelsus himself. Yet it must be exhibited with discretion. Zwingerius likens it to the sword of Skanderberg, which is either good or bad, strong or weak, as is the party that prescribes or uses it. A worthy medicine, if it be rightly applied to a strong man, otherwise it may prove but a froward vomit. Indeed, the name is said to signify monk's bane."
"So I have always understood," said Jack. "But what I really meant was its effect on guns was a little mixed with the powder."
"Alas, I'm wholly ignorant of these things. But if we may go by analogy, it should cause the piece to vomit forth the ball with more than common force."
"We shall soon know," said Jack. "Mr. Pullings, I believe we may beat to quarters."
It was common knowledge throughout the Worcester that something was up, and none of the seamen was particularly surprised when, after a preliminary running in and out of the guns, the captain walked forward along the gangway through the hush of a ship stripped for battle, all hands silent at their action stations, the officers and midshipmen by their divisions, deck after deck, the powder boys sitting on their cartridges behind each gun, the slow match smouldering in the tubs and sending its heady scent eddying along the deck as the tensely expectant Worcester lay to in the grey and empty channel, heaving high but easy on the swell. They were not particularly surprised when, on reaching the starboard bow-chaser, whose first captain was his own coxswain, Barrett Bondon, he took out his watch and said,
"Three rounds, fire on the roll!"
The usual crashing roar, the stab of flame, and the usual furious, ordered activity of the crew in the billowing smoke, sponging, reloading with the practice powder, ball and wad rammed home, the gun heaved up and primed, everything directed at cutting a few seconds off the time between the discharges. For this was the gun crew that was to set the standard by which the rest would be compared. No surprise here, though a keen appreciation of their speed. But amazement, sheer amazement fore and aft, when in 51 seconds flat, Bondon clapped his match to the priming of the second charge, and the gun uttered an enormously loud, high-pitched, unnatural screeching bellow, jetting out a vast tongue of brilliant white light, in which the fragments of wad showed momentarily black. It was a miracle alone that prevented the astonished crew from being crushed by the recoiling gun, and Jack had to tally on to the train-tackle to stop it running out again, unchecked, on the downward roll. He, too, wore the same blank look of wonder as those about him, but quicker than the rest he changed it to the Olympian calm appropriate to a captain. And when Bondon took the rope, muttering,
"Beg pardon, sir, I wasn't expecting,"
He returned to the counting of the seconds and observed,
"Come, Bondon, you're wasting time."
They did their best. They heaved valiantly, but their rhythm, their coordination, was upset, and a full 2 minutes passed before the gun was run up, primed and pointed, and Bondon bent over it with an expression of ludicrous apprehension on his tough, battle-hardened face. His mates all edging as far from the piece as was decent, or even farther, in an atmosphere of the most lively tension. His hand came down. This time the gun belched crimson, a noble, long-lasting crimson flame and crimson smoke, a deep, solemn, musical boom, and all along the deck the exact discipline of the gun crews dissolved in delighted laughter.
"Silence, fore and aft!" cried Jack,
cuffing a contorted powder boy, but his voice trembled as he said,
"Stop your vent! How's your gun? On the roll, fire three!"
After the first dull blast of the regulation powder with which it had been loaded, number three produced a splendid blue, a splendid green, and so it went throughout the ship, deck after deck, exquisite colours, strange unheard-of bangs, infinite mirth, though sternly repressed, and a truly wretched performance in point of time.
"That was the most cheerful exercise I've ever known in my life," said Jack to Stephen in the after cabin. "How I wish you had seen Bondon's face, just like a maiden aunt made to hold a lighted squib. And it was almost as good as a real action for pulling the people together. Lord, how they were laughing on the lower deck when hammocks were being slung. We shall make a happy ship of her, for all her faults. If the wind holds, I shall take her in close tomorrow evening and let them break some glass."
In his long career, Captain Aubrey had observed that of all the forms of great gun exercise, there was none that came anywhere near firing at a fixed mark on land, above all if it had windows. Until the gun crews were quite steady, they tended to throw away many of their shots in full-blown action, and although firing at barrels laid out by the boats was very well in its way, infinitely better than the dumb show of merely heaving cannon in and out that was usual in many ships, it lacked the high relish, the point of real danger, of smashing valuable defended property. And whenever circumstances allowed, he would take his ship close to the enemy shore to bombard some one of the many small posts and batteries strung all along the coast to guard harbours, estuaries, and places where the Allies might land. Now, the breeze having come well north of east with every sign of backing farther still, he fixed his position by two exact lunar observations, and altered course to raise the Ile de Croix a little before the break of day. Although the night turned thick and troubled in the middle watch, no moon to be seen, still less a star, he was confident of his calculations, precisely confirmed by the mean of his three chronometers, and although his chief hope was of some privateer slipping out of Brest, or even a commerce-raiding frigate, if he missed of them, he would at least be able to provide his people with a fine selection of posts to batter. A little before 2 bells in the morning watch he came on deck. The idlers had not yet been called, and the quiet night-time routine still had some while to run before the washing of the decks began and the tumult of holy stones great and small. The swell had diminished, and here, under the remote but effective lee of Ushant, far astern, the breeze made no more than a steady, regular song in the rigging as it came in 3 points abaft the larboard beam. She was under courses and topsails, no more. Since the arrival of the other lieutenants, Pullings no longer kept a watch, but he was already up, talking to Mowat by the larboard rail. Both had their night glasses trained southeast.
"Good morning, gentlemen," said Jack.
"Good morning, sir," said Pullings. "We were just talking about you."
Place, on the forecastle lookout, thought he saw a light. Mowat sent a sharp man aloft. He can make nothing of it. But sometimes we seem to catch something on the lift, and we were wondering whether to call you yet. It is all wrong for the Guah lighthouse."
Jack took the telescope and stared hard and long.
"So goddamned thick,"
he muttered, wiping his eye and staring again. The half-hour glass turned, 2 bells struck. The sentries called, "All's well!" The midshipman of the watch heaved the log, reported,
5 knots 1 fathom, sir, if you please,"
and chalked it on the board. A carpenter's mate stated that there was 2 foot 4 inches in the well. The Worcester made a good deal of water, and Mowat said,
"Relieve the wheel. Forecastle hands spell the afterguard at the pumps. Call the idlers."
"There, sir," cried Pullings. "No, much nearer."
and at the same moment the forecastle lookout and the masthead roared, "Sail on the larboard beam!" The mists of the dying night had parted, showing not only a stern lantern and a top light, but the whole of a ghostly ship, sailing large, standing south and not 2 miles away. Jack had just time to see that she was taking in her for-to-gallant sail before she vanished. Vanished entirely.
"All hands," he said. "Douse the lights. In, driver. Main and fore-to-gallants. For staysail, out a jib. Pass the word to the master."
He caught up the logboard and strode into the master's day cabin with its charts spread out, the Worcester's course pricked to the last observation. Gill came running, frowsty and dishevelled, a glum companion, but a channel pilot and a fine navigator, and between them they worked out the ship's position. Lorient lay due east, and the day would show them the Ile de Groix fine on the starboard bow. If the weather cleared at all, they would see its light well before true dawn.
"A considerable ship, sir?" asked the master. "I hope so indeed, Mr. Gill," said Jack, walking out of the cabin.
He was in fact certain of it, but he did not like to anger luck by saying that what he had seen was either a heavy frigate or even something far better, a ship of the line stealing down the coast to Rochefort. In either case, a man of war, and necessarily a French man of war, since the Worcester had such a head start over the blockading squadron. The decks were filling rapidly with the watch below, blundering about half-clothed and stupid, snatched from their short hour's sleep, but brightening wonderfully when they heard there was a ship in sight.
"A two-decker, sir," said Pullings with a delighted grin. "She took in her main-to-gallant before she disappeared again."
"Very good, Mr. Pullings," said Jack. "Clear for action. Let the people go quietly to quarters. No drum, no calling out."
It was clear that the stranger, now looming faintly through the haze from time to time, had reduced sail to watch for the blink of the Groix light, a further proof that she was bound for Rochefort or the Bordeaux stream, since if her destination had been Lorient, she would have borne in with the land an hour ago. The sky was lightening in the east, and he stood there with his glass considering his course of action amidst the strange silence of the deck, men absurdly whispering as they stood by their guns, the guns themselves eased gently out, orders passing in an undertone. Below he could hear the cabins going down as the carpenter's crew made a clear sweep from stem to stern. The cry of a parson, untimely roused, came up through the hatchway, where they were laying the fear-naught screens and wetting them. There was still the possibility of the stranger's being a storeship or a transport, in which case she would bear up for Lorient the moment she saw the Worcester. He also observed, with grave concern, that with no more than courses and topsails, she was gliding along at a remarkable pace. A clean-bottomed ship, no doubt, and one that could probably give the Worcester mainsail and t'gallants, once all canvas was aboard. But if she was what he hoped, and if she showed fight, he must draw her down well south of Lorient, right to leeward, so that with this wind she could never make that port and the protection of its tremendous batteries. To be sure, that would mean playing long bowls with the Frenchmen for a while, and although they might not be the best seamen in the world, they were often capital gunners, and his ship's company lacked experience. With a sudden stab at his heart, he remembered that he had forgotten to order fighting cartridge instead of practice powder at the last recharging of the guns. This was dead against his principles, but in fact it did not signify. He had carefully observed the fall of the shot, and the coloured powder threw its ball as well as the King's best red LG. In any case, as soon as the stranger was another mile to leeward, too far to fetch Lorient, he must close. He had the immense advantage of being ready, cleared for action, all hands on deck, guns run out, and already Pullings had the stunsail booms and royals laid along. It would be strange if after the surprise and hurry and confusion aboard the Frenchman during the 7 or 8 minutes needed to gain that mile, it would be strange if he did not manage to lay her alongside, above all with the island and its shoals lying so awkwardly in her path.
"Mr. Whiting," he said, "prepare the French colours, the number 77, and some kind of an answer to their private signal. Let it jam in the halyards."
The near haze lifted, and there she lay. A 74, high, taut, and handsome. Probably the Jemappe. At all events, no ship to decline battle. Yet they were strangely inactive aboard her. The Worcester was coming up on them fast, steering for their starboard quarter, running off that precious distance south of Lorient, but they never stirred. Suddenly he realized that every man jack aboard her was staring for the Groix light. It came, sharp and clear, a double flash. She dropped her t'gansels, and while they were sheeting home, someone caught sight of the Worcester. He distinctly heard trumpets aboard the Frenchman, trumpets and the urgent thunder of a drum. His eyes were so used to the half-light that even without a glass he could see people hurrying about on her decks. After a few moments her colours ran up, and she changed helm to cut the Worcester's course.
"Edge off 2 points," said Jack to the master at the con.
This would bring them still farther south.
"Mr. Whiting, French colours, if you please. Mr. Pullings, battle lanterns."
Battle lanterns aboard the Frenchman, too, lights showing in every port, guns running out. The French number and private signal. The Worcester's slow and evasive reply, which did not deceive the enemy for more than a few moments. Yet even those few moments carried the two ships a furlong farther south, and in a very short while now the Jemappe, for the Jemappe she was, would no longer be able to haul up for Lorient. Not that she showed the least sign of wishing to do so, far from it. Her commander was bringing her out in the most handsome manner, evidently determined to join issue as soon as possible, as though he had heard Lord Nelson's maxim, "Never mind manoeuvres, always go straight at 'em." In earlier years, Jack would have lain to for the Jemappe in much the same generous spirit, but now he wanted to make doubly sure of her. He wanted her to try for the weather gauge, and he kept the Worcester away another point and a half, watching the enemy intently as the two ships ran, each abreasting the sea with a fine bow wave. Hammocks were racing up on deck aboard the Jemappe. Her waist and forecastle was a pretty scene of confusion, and in that man's place, with such a clean-bottomed, swift-sailing ship, Jack would have held off until his people were more nearly settled. But not at all. Out she came as fast as she could pelt, and Jack saw that his estimate of her speed had been short of the mark. She was indeed a flyer, and once the vital mile was run off, he would have to close as fast as ever he could, while he still had the advantage of wind and readiness, close and board. He had never known it fail. All along the Worcester's decks the arms chests lay open, pistols, cutlasses, wicked boarding axes. He saw the flash of the Frenchman's chaser, the cloud of smoke torn away ahead, and a white plume rose from the grey sea well beyond the Worcester's starboard bow.
"Our colours, Mr. Whiting," he said,
fixing the enemy quarter-deck in his telescope, and much louder,
"Main top there! Hoist the short pennant!"
He saw the shift of helm that would bring the Jemappe broadside on. She turned, turned, and vanished in a cloud of smoke billowing to her topsails, the single timber-shattering discharge that only a stout new ship could afford. The line was good, but they had fired a trifle past the height of the roll, and their well-grouped shot tore up a broad patch of sea 100 yards short. A dozen ricochets came aboard, one smashing the blue cutter. A hole appeared in the mainsail, and some blocks fell to the deck behind him. There had been no time to rig netting. A subdued cheer from the forecastle and waist, and many an eye looked aft for the order to fire. On the edge of his field of vision, he saw Stephen standing by the break of the poop in his nightshirt and breeches. Dr. Maturin rarely went to his action station in the cockpit until there were casualties for him to deal with, but Jack Aubrey's mind was too taken up with the delicate calculations of the coming battle for conversation. He stood there, wholly engrossed, working out the converging courses, the possible variants, the innumerable fine points that must precede the plain, hard hammering, when everyone would be much happier. On these occasions, and Stephen had known many of them, Jack was, as it were, removed, a stranger, quite unlike the cheerful, not overwise companion he knew so well. A hard, strong face, calm but intensely alive, efficient, decided, a stern face, but one that in some way expressed a fierce and vivid happiness. A full minute passed. The second French broadside must be rammed home by now. He would have to suffer two or three of them, and at shortening range before he could carry out his plan. But a fresh crew hated being fired at without making a reply.
"One more," he said in his strong voice, "one more, and then you shall serve them out. Then wait for the word and fire at her tops. Fire steady. Do not waste a shot!
A fierce growl all along, then the Frenchman's roaring fire, and almost at the same moment the great hammer crash of round shot hitting the Worcester's hull, splinters flying across the deck, wreckage falling from aloft.
"Do not do that, youngster,"
said Jack to little Calamy, who had bent double when a shot crossed the quarter-deck.
"You might put your head in the way of a ball."
He glanced fore and aft. No great harm, and he was about to give the order to bear up fire when the wounded main-tack tore free.
"Clew up! Clew up!"
he said, and the wild flapping stopped.
"Starboard 3 points."
3 points of starboard it is, sir," said the quartermaster at the wheel,
and in a long, smooth glide the Worcester brought her guns to bear. She was head-on to the swell, a fair pitch, but no roll.
"Wait for it,"
he called.
"At her tops, waste not a shot. At the word from forward aft."
The wind sang through the rigging. The Frenchmen would be almost running out their guns again. That was the moment to catch them. He must get his broadside in first, fluster them, and hide his ship in smoke.
"Bow guns, stand by! Fire!"
From forward aft, the long, rolling fire, an enormous, all-pervading roar, and a freak of the wind brought the dense smoke eddying back. Red smoke, green, blue, crimson and orange, with unearthly tongues of intensely brilliant coloured flame in the greyness. He leapt onto the hammock cloths to pierce the cloud, the unnatural cloud, yet still it lingered, and no reply from the Jemappe.
"God love me, what's amiss?"
he said aloud, while below him the gun crews sponged, loaded, rammed, and heaved like fury, fresh powder running up from the magazines. The smoke cleared at last, and there was the Jemappe, stern on, running fast, apparently unhurt, apart from a small green fire blazing on her poop, running close-hauled for Lorient, shocked and appalled by these new secret weapons. She was already packing on more sail. The guns were run out again. At 3 degrees of elevation he gave her another broadside, a raking broadside at her defenceless stern, a broadside delivered with a fierce, savage cheer. But though several shots struck her hull, they did not check her speed, nor did the now normal flash of the Worcester's fire induce her to lie to, and by the time Jack called,
"Hard a starboard!"
to go in chase, she had gained a quarter of a mile, while fools were capering on the forecastle, cheering, bawling out,
"She runs! She runs! We've beat her!"
The Worcester hauled her wind, the sail trimmers leapt to the braces and flew aloft to set the upper staysails, but she could not lie as close to her quarry by nearly a whole point, nor, without her mainsail, could she run on a bowline so fast by 2 knots and more. When the Jemappe was so far ahead that the bow chaser could hardly reach her, Jack yawned, gave her one last, deliberate, sullen broadside at extreme range, and said,
"How's your guns, Mr. Gill? Course south-southwest, all plain sail."
He realized that it was day, that the sun was rising over Lorient, and added,
"Douse the battle lanterns."
As he spoke, he saw Pulling's face, and the cruel disappointment on it. Had they held their opening fire another 5 minutes, the Jemappe could never have reached Lorient. With the wind, the Ile de Groix, its reefs, and the shore all lying just so, a close action could have been forced whether the Jemappe held her course or no. 5 minutes longer, and Pullings would either have been a commander or a corpse, for a successful, evenly matched action was certain promotion for a surviving first lieutenant. Pullings' only possible chance of promotion from the long and overcrowded lieutenant's list— since he had no pull, no interest or influence of any kind, no hope apart from his patron's luck or superior ability. And Jack Aubrey had misjudged the situation, one that might never arise again in Tom Pulling's whole career. Jack felt a sadness rise, far greater than his usual depression after a real battle, and looking at the dangling main tack, he said in a hard voice,
"What are our casualties, Mr. Pullings?"
"No dead, sir. 3 splinter wounds and a crushed foot, no more, and number 7, lower deck, dismounted. But I'm sorry to tell you, sir, I'm very sorry to tell you, the doctor has copped it."
Chapter 3. Dr. Maturin had taken part in many actions at sea, and although he had twice been captured and once wrecked, He had never copped it yet, because as a surgeon he spent most of the time below the waterline, sheltered from splinters, round shot, and grape, in comparative safety if not in comfort. But now he had been wounded in three several places. First a falling shoulder block knocked him down, then a jagged lump of elm from the hounds of the mizzen topmast ripped off half his scalp, and lastly one of a shower of 18-inch splinters driven from the Worcester's quarter-deck berthing by a 32-pound ball struck both his feet as he lay there, struck them flatwise, piercing the list slippers and his soles. The wounds were spectacular, and he left an uninterrupted trail of blood as he was carried below, but they were not serious. His assistants sewed him up again. Lewis, the elder man, was a rare hand with a needle, and although the pain was singularly shrill and insistent, Stephen's favourite tincture of laudanum dealt with that. He could take it now with a clear conscience, and with the tolerance resulting from long abuse he drank it by the pint. It was not the wounds, therefore, nor the loss of blood, nor the pain that brought him so low, but rather the incessant flow of visitors. His assistants left him pretty well alone, apart from attending to his dressings, for not only was he a dangerous patient, stubborn, dogged, and even violent if attempted to be dosed according to any system but his own, but he was also their superior in naval and in medical rank, being a physician and the author of highly esteemed works on seamen's diseases, an officer much caressed by the sick and hurt board. Furthermore, he was no more consistent than other men, and in spite of his liberal principles and his dislike of constituted authority, he was capable of petulant tyranny when confronted with a slime draught early in the morning. But he had no authority over the Worcester's passengers, and with regard to them the social contract was fully binding. It was their duty to visit the sick unless they were being sick themselves, and poor Dr. Davis was prostrated by the slightest roll or pitch. They had nothing else at all to do, and throughout their leisurely, almost windless and unnaturally calm passage across the Bay of Biscay and down the coast of Portugal, they succeeded one another in the captain's dining cabin, where Stephen's cot had been set up. Nor were they alone. His old shipmates Pullings and Mowat sat with him every day, and very welcome they were. But all the other members of the wardroom came in from time to time, walking on tiptoe and suggesting remedies, in low, considerate tones. Men who had listened to him with respectful attention when he was well now gave him advice quite fearlessly, and Killick hovered near at hand with fortifying broth, possets made by the gunner's wife, and galley receipts for strengthening the blood. Had it not been for the blessed opium that allowed him to plane above his irascibility some of the time, his well-wishers would have worried him into his coffin, a hammock with two round-shot at his feet, before they raised the Rock of Lisbon. For although he could put up with pain tolerably well, he had always found boredom mortal, and the purser, the marine captain, strangers to him, and two of the parsons droned on and on. Apart from the inventor of the double-bottomed defecator, whose history he had heard seven times, they had nothing to say, and they said it for what seemed hours, while his smile grew more fixed and rigid, until at last it came to resemble the risus sardonicus. But in latitude 38 degrees north he began to recover. The feverish petulance left him. He became equable and mild, and his complaisance was no longer a matter of strong self-restraint. He discovered agreeable qualities in two of the clergymen and Professor Graham. When Cape St. Vincent showed misty on the larboard bow, he was well enough to be carried on deck in an elbow chair with two capstan bars lashed to its sides, sedan fashion, to be shown the desert of grey ocean in which Lieutenant Aubrey, Sir John Jervis, and Commodore Nelson had defeated the greatly superior Spanish fleet on St. Valentine's Day in 1797. And when the Worcester lay alongside the New Mole in Gibraltar, taking in fresh supplies and waiting for the Levanter to blow out, the strong east wind that prevented her from passing the strait into the Mediterranean, he sat luxuriating in the sun, in the stern galley, his bandaged feet on a stool, a glass of fresh orange juice in his hand, and Professor Graham by his side. For although the Scotchman was a grey, somewhat positive, humourless soul, he had read a great deal, and now he had overcome at least some of his initial reserve, he was a grateful companion, a man of obvious parts, and in no way a bore. Stephen had received the visit of several acquaintances from the shore, the last of these bringing him specimens of four uncommon cryptogams that he had always longed to see. He gazed at them now with such pleasure, such intensity, that it was some moments before he answered the professor's question.
"What was the language you were speaking with that gentleman?"
"The language, sir?" he said with a smile. He was feeling unusually cheerful, even merry. "It was Catalan." He had been tempted to say Aramaic out of a spirit of fun, but Graham was too learned, too much of a linguist, to swallow that.
"So you speak the Catalan, Doctor, as well as the French and Spanish?"
"I have spent much of my life on the shores of the Mediterranean," said Stephen, "and in my malleable youth I came by a certain knowledge of the languages spoken at its western end. I do not possess your command of Arabic, however, still less of your Turkish, God forbid."
"To revert to our battle," said Graham, having digested this. "What I do not understand is why Captain Aubrey should have shot off those extraordinary coloured balls in the first place."
"As for that," said Stephen, smiling at Graham's notion of a battle, from their noble balcony there the whole bay spread out before them, with Algeciras on the farther shore, where he had taken part in a real action, 142 casualties in HMS Hannibal alone, blood and thunder all day long.
You must know that in their wisdom the Lords of the Admiralty have laid down that for the first 6 months of his commission no captain may presume to fire more shot a month than one-third the number of his guns, under various heavy mulcts and penalties, and after that only half as many. Whitehall supposes that the mariners know how to direct their pieces accurately and shoot them off at great speed while the ship is tossing on the billows by instinct. The captains who do not share this amiable illusion buy their own powder, if they can afford it. But powder is costly. A broadside from a ship of this size uses up some 200 weight, I believe."
"Hoot toot," said Graham, deeply shocked.
"Hoot toot indeed, sir," said Stephen, "and at 1 and 10 pence farthing the pound that comes to a considerable sum."
"20, 19, 5," said Graham.
£20 English, 19 shillings and 5 pence. So you will understand that captains seek the best market for their private powder. This came from a fireworks manufactory, hence the unusual colours."
"There was no intention to deceive, then?"
"Est summum nefas fallere. Deceit is gross impiety, my dear sir."
Graham stared. Then his grave, grey face adopted a somewhat artificial smile, and he said,
"You speak facetiously, no doubt. But the false colours, the French flag was certainly intended to draw the enemy closer, so that he might be more readily destroyed, and it almost succeeded. I wonder we did not raise the signal of distress, or even pretend to surrender. That would have brought them closer still."
"To the nautical mind, some false signals are falser than other false signals. At sea there are clearly understood degrees of iniquity. An otherwise perfectly honourable sea officer may state by symbol that he is a Frenchman, but he must not state that his ship has struck upon a rock, nor must he lower his colours and then start to fight again, upon pain of universal reprehension. He would have the hiss of the world against him, of the maritime world.
The end proposed is the same in either case, the deception equal. I should certainly hoist all the colours in the spectrum, were it to advance the fall of that wicked man by 5 minutes. I refer to the self-styled Emperor of the French. War is a time for efficient action, not for the display of fine feelings, nor the discussion of the relative merits of forgery and false pretences."
"It is illogical, I admit," said Stephen, "but this is the moral law, as perceived by the nautical mind."
"The nautical mind," said Graham. "Hoot toot."
"The nautical mind has its own logic," said Stephen, "and although it may disobey many of the articles of war with a clear conscience, swearing is forbidden, for example, and yet we daily hear warm, intemperate language, even blasphemous and obscene, so is the sudden, spontaneous beating of men who are thought to move too slowly, or starting, as we call it. But you may see a certain amount of it even in this ship, which is more humane than most. Yet all these transgressions, and many more, such as that stealing of stores which we term capybara, or the neglect of religious feasts, are carried only to certain clearly understood traditional limits, beyond which it is mortal to go. The seaman's moral law may seem strange to landsmen, even whimsical at times, but as we all know, pure reason is not enough, and illogical as their system may be, it does enable them to conduct these enormously complex machines from point to point in spite of the elements, often boisterous, often adverse, always damp and always capricious.
"It is a perpetual source of wonder to me that they arrive so often," said Graham, "and I remember what a friend of mine wrote on the subject. Having taken proper notice of the complexity of the machine, as you so rightly observe, the infinity of ropes and cords, the sails, the varying forces that act upon them, and the skill required to manage the whole, directing the vessel in the desired direction, he went on to this effect. What a pity it is that an art so important, so difficult, and so intimately concerned with the invariable laws of mechanical nature should be so held by its possessors that it cannot improve, but must die with each individual. Having no advantages of previous education, they cannot arrange their thoughts, they can scarcely be said to think, they can far less express or communicate to others the intuitive knowledge which they possess, and their art, acquired by habit alone, is little different from an instinct. We are as little entitled to expect improvement here as in the architecture of the bee, or the beaver. The species cannot improve."
"Perhaps your friend was unfortunate in his sea-going acquaintance," said Stephen, smiling, "as unfortunate as he was in his reference to the bee and her building, which is surely confessed by all mathematicians to be geometrically perfect, and therefore not susceptible of improvement. But leaving the bee aside, for my part I have sailed with mariners who are not only active in improving the architecture of their machines and the art of conducting them, but who were only too willing to communicate the knowledge they possessed. Such tales have I heard of Captain Bentinck's palls, or rather shrouds, and his triangular courses, of Captain Pakenham's newly discovered rudder, of Captain Bolton's jury-mast, of improved iron horses, dogs, dolphins, mouses, or mice, as some say, puddings.
"Puddings, my dear sir?" cried Graham.
"Puddings. We try some athwart the starboard gumbrils when sailing by and large."
"The starboard gumbrils, by and large," said Graham,
and with a passing qualm Stephen recalled that the professor had an unusually good memory, could quote long passages naming the volume, chapter, and even page from which they came.
"My ignorance is painful to me. As an old experienced seafarer, you understand these things, of course."
Stephen bowed and went on, keeping to slightly safer ground.
"Not to mention the countless devices to measure the speed of the vessel through the water by means of rotating vanes, or the pressure of the circumambient ocean, machines as ingenious as the double-bottomed defecator. That reminds me. Pray, what qualifications are called for in an Anglican clergyman? What attendance at a seminary? What theological studies?"
"I believe he must have taken his degree at one of the universities, and certainly he must have found a bishop willing to ordain him. My impression is that nothing more is required, no seminary, no theological studies. But I am sure you know more of the Anglican polity than I, since, like so many of my countrymen, I am a Presbyterian."
"Not I, since, like so many of mine, I am a Catholic."
"Indeed? I had supposed that all officers in the Navy were obliged to forswear the Pope."
"So they are too, the commissioned officers, but surgeons are appointed by a warrant from the Navy Board. I forswore nothing, which was a comfort, to be sure. Yet, on the other hand, without renouncing the Bishop of Rome, I can scarcely look forward to being an admiral and hoisting my flag. The height of naval ambition is denied me."
"I do not understand. Surely a gentleman in the physical line can never hope to be an admiral. But you are pleased to be jocose, I have no doubt."
Jocularity did not please Professor Graham. He looked somewhat offended, as though he had been trifled with, and shortly afterwards he took his leave. But he was back again the next afternoon, and he and Stephen now gazed upon the Rock at short range, the Worcester having been removed to make room for the Brunswick and Goliath, and Pullings having swung her stern on so that her starboard side could be scraped and painted. It was one of those days when some particular quality in the light, and not merely the brilliance of the sun, makes colours glow and sing. A military band was playing on the Alameda, its brasses blazing like gold beneath the shade, while through the gardens and up and down the grand parade flowed an easy crowd of redcoats, blue jackets, and a wonderful variety of civilian clothes from Europe, Morocco, the Turkish provinces of Africa, Greece and the Levant, and even from much farther east, white turbans and the pale dust-blue robes of Tangier Copts, the dark red and broad straw hats of Berbers, and the black of Barbary Jews moved in and out among the pepper trees, mingling with tall Moors and Negroes, kilted Greek seamen from the islands, red-capped Catalans, and small Malays in green. On Jumper's Bastion stood a group of the Worcester's young gentlemen, some long and thin, others very small indeed, and Stephen noticed that they seemed to be gathered about a monstrous dog. But as they moved off, it became apparent that the creature was a calf, a black bull calf. Other Worcesters wandered among the geraniums and castor oil plants. These were the select bands of liberty men, those who had had the time and the foresight to provide themselves with white or black-varnished, low-crowned hats with the ship's name embroidered on the ribbon, watchet blue jackets with brass buttons, spotless white duck trousers, and little shoes. Each had had to pass the master-at-arms inspection, for although the Worcester was not yet a crack ship or anything remotely like one, Pullings was very jealous of her reputation, and he acted on the principle that the appearance of virtue might induce its real presence. Few of them were drunk yet, and most of their mirth, clearly audible at half a mile, was the effect of pure, unaided gaiety. Beyond them and the variegated crowd rose the grey and tawny rock, green only at its lower rim, and above its long crest the strange fog or breeding cloud brought into being by the Levanter, a breeding cloud that dissipated there in the blazing light of the western side. Stephen had Mount Misery clear in his telescope, and sharp against the whitish sky an ape, high above the ape, a vulture hanging on the wind. Both Stephen and the ape gazed at the bird. Professor Graham cleared his throat.
"Dr. Maturin," he said, "I have a cousin who occupies a confidential post under government. He is concerned with the gathering of information more reliable than newspaper or mercantile or even consular reports, and he has asked me to look out for gentlemen who might assist him. I know little of these things. They are far outside my province. But it occurs to me that a medical man, fluent in the Mediterranean languages, with a wide acquaintance scattered about these shores, would be unusually well suited for such purposes, above all if he were of the Romish persuasion. For it appears that most of my cousin's colleagues are Protestants, and clearly a Protestant cannot enter into the intimacy of Catholics as well as their co-religionists. Allow me to add that my cousin disposes of considerable funds."
The distant ape shook its fist at the vulture. The enormous bird tilted, and gliding sideways, crossed the strait to Africa without a movement of its wings. A fulvous vulture, Stephen observed with satisfaction, as the colour showed upon the tern.
"Why, as for that," he said, putting down his telescope, "I am afraid I should make but an indifferent source of information. Even in a small town, and you must have noticed how closely a ship resembles a small crowded town with its hierarchy, its people all knowing one another, its particular walks and places of refreshment for the different classes, its perpetual gossip, even in a town a medical man rarely gets away. But a ship is a town that carries its walls with it wherever it goes. A naval surgeon is tied to his post, and even when the ship is in port he is still much taken up with his patients and with paperwork, so that he sees little of the country or its inhabitants. Oh, it is the pity of the world to travel so far and to see so little."
"Yet, surely, sir, you do go on to dry land from time to time?"
"Not nearly as often as I could wish, sir. No, I am afraid I should be of little use to your cousin. And then again the necessary dissimulation, the disguise, the lack of candour, I may even say the deceit called for in such an undertaking would be mighty distasteful. But now that I come to think of it, would not a naval chaplain answer your purpose very well? He has far more time to spare on shore. There are our clerical shipmates, as you see, walking about as free as air with others of their kind, there, just by the Dragon Tree.
"No, my dear sir, that is a common plane. To the right of the date palms. The dragon tree, for all love."
Beneath the dragon tree's green shade paced 12 clergymen, 6 from the Worcester, 6 from the garrison, all clean-shaved, discreetly admiring the majestic beards, Arabian, Hebrew, and Berber, that passed them on the parade.
"We say farewell to all of them but one," observed Professor Graham. "The wardroom will seem strangely bare."
"Indeed," said Stephen. "5 at one blow? I had heard that Mr. Simpson and Mr. Wells were to leave us, Goliath and Brunswick having arrived, but what is to become of the others, and who is to remain?"
"Mr. Martin is to stay."
"Mr. Martin?"
"The one-eyed gentleman. And Mr. Powell and Mr. Comfrey are to go straight to Malta in that storeship over there."
"The Zeebeck or the Polacre?"
"The vessel to the right," said Graham somewhat testily. "The vessel that is so busy with sailors creeping up the masts. And Dr. Davis has decided to go home by land as far as ever he can. He finds the sea does not suit his constitution, and is casting about for a suitable conveyance."
"He is quite right, sure. For a man of his age, and in his state of health, it would be death to be boxed up in a confined, moist, uneasy, tossing habitation, either airless, or with so much of it that one's whole person is battered and assailed, to say nothing of the falling damps, so fatal to those that have passed the climacteric. No, to go to sea a man needs youth, an adamantine health, and the digestion of a hyena. But I hope the poor gentleman will be able to attend the farewell dinner. Great preparations are making, I am told. The captain is coming, and I look forward eagerly to the feast myself. I am sick of eggs and bonny clabber, and that villain," nodding in the direction of Killick, who was banging chairs about in the great cabin behind them before bringing in a host of swabbers to make the place a wet, spotless misery, "will bring me nothing else."
Dr. Davis was not able to attend. He was in a Spanish diligence, with 8 mules drawing him as fast as they could away from everything connected with the sea. But he sent his excuses, his best compliments, his best thanks, and his best wishes, and they filled his chair with a lean, deserving young master's mate called Honey, Joseph Honey. As the church clocks of Gibraltar struck the hour, Captain Aubrey walked into the crowded wardroom, full of blue coats, red coats, and clerical black. His first lieutenant welcomed him and proposed a glass of bitters.
"I'm afraid our company's not quite complete, sir," he said, and turning he silently gibbered at the wardroom steward.
"Can it possibly be that the doctor is late?" asked Jack.
But even as he spoke, there was a muffled thumping, 2 or 3 vile oaths, and Stephen came in on his bandaged feet, his elbows supported by his servant, a quarter-witted but docile and sweet-natured marine, and Killick. They greeted him, not indeed with a cheer, for the captain's presence was a restraint upon them, but very cheerfully. And as they sat down, Mowat said, smiling across the table at him,
"You are looking wonderfully well, dear doctor. I'm happy to see you. But it is not surprising, for even calamity by thought refined inspirits and adorns the thinking mind."
"Why you should suppose that mine requires any adornment, I cannot tell, Mr. Mowat," said Stephen. "You have been cultivating your genius again, I find."
"You remember my weakness, then, sir?"
"Certainly I do. And to prove it, I will repeat certain lines you composed in our first voyage together, our first commission. Oh, were it mine with sacred marrow's art, to wake to sympathy the feeling heart, then might I, with unrivalled strains, deplore the impervious horrors of a leeward shore."
"Very good, capital! Hear him, hear him!" cried several officers,
all of whom had experienced the impervious horrors not once, but many times.
"That's what I call poetry," said Captain Aubrey. "None of you goddamn your blessed maundering about swains and virgins and flowery meads. And since we are on calamities and leeward shores, Mowat, tip us the piece about woe."
"I don't know that I quite remember it, sir," said Mowat, blushing now that the whole table was attending to him.
"Oh, surely you do. The piece about not whining. Plaintless patience, you know. I make my little girls recite it."
"Well, sir, if you insist," said Mowat, laying down his soup spoon.
His normally cheerful, good-natured expression changed to a boding, portentous look. He fixed his eyes on the decanter,
and in a surprisingly loud moo began, "By woe, the soul to daring action swells. By woe, in plaintless patience it excels. From patience prudent clear experience springs, and traces knowledge through the course of things. Thence hope is formed, thence fortitude, success, renown, whate'er men covet and caress."